there's people who look at their aura ring with a level of anxiety that defeats the purpose of having the aura ring in the first place. Well, like, what did I screw up last night? You know, I've been there, and on the other side of it, a whole bunch, like, I learned lessons about what works for me as opposed to just outsourcing it to Andrew Huberman and Peter Attia and Dave Asprey and Ben Greenfield or whoever your particular, you know, superheroes wind up being.
Hey everyone, Ronan here. You're listening to a Good Long Podcast. Sometimes in life, things are so good, you gotta do them twice. And I'm not just talking about drinking Quench Hydration. I'm also talking about having some of your favorite guests back on the podcast to shoot the shit, because that's sometimes just what makes life worth living. And that's exactly what today's episode is. Although he's not the biggest name we've had on the podcast, his first episode, entitled How to Think for Yourself, has generated possibly more interest and feedback than any other. And so it's a true pleasure to have the possibly slightly more enlightened than last time, Ben Askins, aka Rom Doc, back on the show to talk about all sorts of fun and interesting things. As always, this episode is brought to you by Sizzle Brands. If you're thirsty, drink some Quench Hydration. It's super tasty, honestly. You won't regret it. Visit quenchhydration.com and use Levy20 for a discount. That's Quench, spelled C-W-E-N-C-H. Enjoy the conversation.
Well, I've stolen a lot of ideas from you, and I've stolen a new idea, which is I'm trying to make this new iteration of the podcast a little bit more formatted. So I have a series of questions, not the five that you have, but I think maybe the first question is the same. And some of this we'll have talked about in the last iteration, but hopefully we'll have new audience listening to this. So I'm sure they'd love to hear the Ben Doc Askins story. And so we'll start there. But before we start there, let's talk about the news of the day in the industry that brought you and I together, which is the pornography. I mean, the psychedelic industry.
I have a photographic memory.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on the whole advisory council MDMA thing? I think you've probably seen my outrage online, just because it is amazing how much stupidity is executed in the name of adherence and rigor to protocol as opposed to common sense. It really pisses me off when you see those two outcomes diverge, but curious to know your thoughts.
Yeah. I'll be interested to see, you know, what the actual final outcome in August winds up being. This is actually kind of the first hiccup in this process over, you know, it's been a long time that MAPS/Lykos is trying to get MDMA, the MDMA football across the goal line. And now with the advisory council voting almost all thumbs down,
taking a giant dump on it.
Yeah. It's one of those like failure is never final situations, but is it, you know, fatal? We'll see. I'm kind of, like, we're on the new frontier in a whole bunch of ways, and that, like, the objections were primarily around questions of harm related to the therapy, not the medicine, was, yeah, I think, the most surprising thing to me, especially with the way everything was kind of lockstep with the FDA and developing the trials in the first place and then conducting them and, you know, being taken public some of the abuses that took place there that were certainly incredibly negative, but we've been aware of for years. These aren't like new findings where the advisory council should be shocked by some of the things that took place there. But it is an unusual thing to tie a medicine to a particular approach to therapy and, yeah, try to get that across FDA approval rather than just the molecule itself. Does it or doesn't work better than, will it separate from placebo by two or more points like an SSRI has to or whatever? That's not hard to make happen, it would appear. But yeah, I had my questions even whenever I went to the MAPS training, like, how are we doing this, you know, therapy plus medicine thing? And then it was just this week too that the Dutch decided, yeah, MDMA is good to hook. Like, let's get this thing rolled out as fast as we possibly can, just looking at the medicine and the data around the medicine. So lots of questions about, like, why why is this being objected to at this particular stage in the game? It seems like it should have happened much sooner than now, if it was going to happen at all. So I don't know what's going on behind the scenes there. I don't know any of those people or any of the details, but I'm super curious to see how it all rolls out eventually, you know?
Yeah, it's so interesting. I mean, like, I have a whole bunch of thoughts. One is, like, it's interesting that, I mean, therapy, anytime you introduce people into the conversation, there's a risk that people do bad things. This right? is not news. Okay. Just like any surgery requires a surgeon who could do bad things in the surgery room while you're doing it, right? You, like, a lot of things sure. that the FDA approves requires some sort of integration with the service. And so just because therapy is a little bit less tangible, it's like, why can't you wrap your head around this? And, you know, isn't it better to have people taking psychotropic drugs while in the presence of compassionate people instead of just giving them drugs and letting them run around? Like, how can that not be a better outcome? It reminds me of the early days when I was in the cannabis industry and you know, we were trying to educate doctors, and because cannabis doesn't fit into a nice little square box where you prescribe an exact amount, it's very iterative, it's subjective, but it works. And doctors, honestly, so many of them were just dumbfounded, and they're like, I won't touch it because I don't understand it. I'm like, what's not to understand? People use it, they figure out how much works, and it makes them feel better. It's like, you know, that's it. But it just doesn't fit right. into the mental math of what doctors were used to. And, you know, maybe it's the personality type of a lot of doctors. Maybe it's just bad medical system, you know, how we educate. I don't know what it is, but it really is like, we create these rules, we create these policies and procedures, and I get they're there for a reason, but we should also have the wisdom and the courage to step outside of them when it makes sense. Like, you know, apparently the U.S. Navy was designed by geniuses to be run by idiots. and so I feel like that's kind of relevant here, which is like some yeah. of these processes were designed by geniuses, but apparently we've left it to idiots to run it in yeah. many ways, it feels.
Well, it just, you know, you got to keep the end user in mind. Like, the guy at the end is going to look for, like, where's the big red button? This is what I need to know, is when to push the big red button. Today yep. is not the day. Don't push it.
yeah.
Tomorrow might be the day, but wait. And it's like, oh, okay. But you don't understand the background of the whole machine that's launching all these missiles or whatever. Joey Bear at the end of this thing just needs to know, push or don't push, yeah. push or don't push. And that's, you know, what you're dealing with at a certain level. I do think there's a lot of interesting philosophical questions in the background that are raised by just studying psychedelics in a clinical trial design sort of scenario, you know, like and these were questions I kind of brought up when I went through some of the MAPS training and never got fully satisfactory answers to, was, you know, the double blind placebo controlled, you know, randomized trial has become the gold standard in medicine, but how closely mental health, you know, mirrors microbiology approaches to, like, you know, you got depression, you get an antidepressant, you got an infection, you get an antibiotic or an antifungal. These aren't quite the same things.
Yep. And,
you know, brain isn't exactly like a petri dish, and it doesn't translate quite that easily. But I had questions about, you know, that was the other question that the advisory council raised, was around unblinding.
Yeah.
Like, you take MDMA, 99.9 out of 99.9 people are going to know that they took MDMA and not a sugar pill. But what about designing a trial that recognizes that and then does some kind of, like, comparative efficacy? We do this in surgery where somebody gets a particular surgery and then a sham surgery where they go through all the steps but don't actually get their hip replaced or whatever the case might be, and see if this hip replacement actually does improve functionality, or if, you know, snowing somebody through the process of going through surgery winds up producing, like, people feel better because yeah. they think, hey, things got better or whatever. Like, what is the placebo effect in the first place might be something that is worth investigating a whole lot more thoroughly than we have, at least as it relates to mental health. So what about you know, what I'd suggested was, what about a comparative efficacy trial where you do head-to-head ketamine versus MDMA for PTSD with, you know, some level of just psychological support and not necessarily some kind of direct, you know, transpersonal psychological intervention. And, you know, you could set somebody up to get saline and MDMA through an IV and ketamine for 6 to 8 hours through an IV or whatever. So that if they're treatment naive, they may not know which particular psychoactive substance they received, and then study it over, you know, 3, 6, 12 months and see what the outcomes wind up looking like. That seems like a way of at least designing a trial that would address some of the questions around unblinding. It's which substance are you being unblinded to, that could address some of this stuff. But like, those questions are really interesting to me. Like, what is the placebo effect even to begin with? And
yeah,
is there a way to just optimize that? You know, maybe we should throw some dollars at that. I don't know. You know,
100% we should be throwing dollars at that. I mean, like, what? Imagine this, that people could get better on their own. Like, you know,
yeah, the tincture of time.
Yeah. Yeah. A little positive self-affirmation. And the other thing, the other philosophical question that came up for me is, like, for those people, you know, it worked for, I think it improved to about 80% of people no longer met the criteria to have PTSD. It started at about 70, and over time people actually got better. And here's the advisory committee being like, you haven't established that it works. I'm like, I don't know. There's those 80% of people, right. And like, there's
Australia
would
disagree.
Yeah. There's those other thousands of people, but I get it from a double blind placebo. You can't say it was the MDMA, as opposed to other things, but it's like, so then the conversation goes into the risk profile. Well, it's like, well, does the risk outweigh the harm? Well, we don't know that it was the MDMA that led to this outcome. It could have been preconceived notions and all that kind of stuff. It's like, but why don't I get to decide what risks I'm willing to take with my body for the outcome that I'm seeking, right? There's that philosophical thing being like, oh shit, that many people seem to swear by this, even though mathematically in the double blind, you may not satisfy yourself because of the trial study. It's like, well, let me decide that, right? It's my body, yeah, not yours. I mean, obviously the US has big issues between, you know, liberty and, not if you're a woman.
For certain people who look like those of us that have liberty already and not anybody else.
Yeah, exactly. So that's the thing that frustrates me. And a lot of that came out of just watching the whole cannabis thing and being firsthand witness to it, being like, get out of the way. Like, doctors, a lot of doctors wouldn't prescribe and wouldn't refer. It's like, well, is that really your decision? Like, yes, you've been saddled with a responsibility for prescribing cannabis because everyone's too scared to let people actually make their own decisions. So now we've put doctors in between you and this medicine. And doctors didn't want that responsibility.
Right.
It's like, well, then just get out of the way, right? Just be like, if you want it, sure. You understand. Here's the piece of paper that talks about the risks. You understand what you're doing. You're a grown adult. You're allowed to vote for who gets to run this country, but you're not allowed to decide what goes into your body. Like, really, how does that math work?
Yeah. It grows in the dirt, man.
Which means we need to put a Prop 65 warning on it for California, which is what I'm learning now.
So many rules, so many arbitrary rules.
It really, you know, yeah. I don't know if there's truth to this, but I remember seeing I think it was on Facebook or somewhere, that to build the same house on, you know, inflation adjusted basis between 1970 and now, to build it in 1970 would cost $75,000, you know, present dollar value. Build it now would cost $750,000 because there's so many added rules and regulations and requirements about how things need to be built. And I get it. You know, I'm sure we've all dealt with contractors who are of questionable nature, but
for sure,
it feels like you want to understand also that
asbestos.
Yeah, well, exactly. Well, I mean, asbestos, it's like, I'm pretty sure it wasn't the contractors who started that, right? But it feels like we've skewed in a little too heavy into regulating every single aspect of life. And no wonder it's so hard to run a business, you know, even through the lens of a business, it takes a fucking lot just to get off the ground, let alone figuring out whether your business works or not.
It's a lot of getting nickeled and dimed to even get started, you know?
Yeah.
Just, I didn't change anything, but you need me to let you know that I didn't change anything and it's going to cost me $50 to let you know that I didn't change anything.
Yeah.
Thank you, overlords, for allowing me to continue to exist.
Yep.
To try to eke out, you know, a meager sum for me and my family.
That's exactly right. All right. And then maybe we'll hop into, I really appreciated your comment about, I used to biohack, but now I'm into intuition or whatever you said. But let's hop into these questions. So the first question is, tell us your story. And a lot of this was covered. Anyone listening, if you want to go back and listen to, I forget what we called that episode. It was one of the episodes I got the most feedback on. Everyone really appreciated your insights and thoughts. But you may hear some of this in a previous episode, but let's hear it again. And you don't have to tell us the whole story, but anyone who wants to read about Ben's life a little bit and have their brains blown in by trying to follow what's going on, be sure to pick up a copy of The Anti-Hero's Journey, because it's quite the read.
Yep, it's just 150 pages with pictures, but you might have to read 300 to get it. It's like a buy one get one sort of deal.
BOGO.
Yeah, my story is apparently a crazy one. I thought it was pretty normal until I started comparing notes along the way.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, I was like, I just was living. And then I picked my head up and started looking around and realized I'd, you know, done some, I feel like a little bit like a psychedelic Forrest Gump or something. Like I didn't contribute ever anywhere, but I stood in the rooms where lots of people were contributing lots of important things along the way or whatever. Hey, there's that guy back in the corner there who's, you know, he's just got to pee and he's going to interrupt this press conference because he had too many Dr. Peppers or whatever. That's kind of my story in a metaphor from a movie. I was raised by like Parks and Rec's character, Ron Swanson, like that level libertarian. He's a caricature, but that was my dad, was like a libertarian caricature come to life. You know, the government's got two jobs, stay out of my pocket and stay out of my backyard or whatever, you know, was the milieu where I was growing up. I was pretty religiously conservative too. Like my dad's retirement plan was like the rapture. And it just didn't pan out for him in the end, or anybody for the last 2,000 years that was banking on that one. But I mean, who knows? I guess they're chipping people now. Maybe it's going to happen. But yeah, I grew up, my dad was a Vietnam vet, SEER school instructor. So I had kind of an unusual upbringing. I didn't realize like other kids weren't camping out on the regular, even though they had a house to live in and weren't like snaring deer in elementary school or that sort of thing. Sort of skill sets that I haven't kept up the way that I'd like to imagine that I have, but a lot of outdoor exposure and a lot of fun growing up there. It was also, I like to describe it as a very loving but occasionally surprisingly violent household, you know. And I've gotten to a place where I'm a lot more comfortable with just the facts around that. I'm not, you know, it's post-traumatic growth in my mind at this point,
right,
to the degree that I'm able to have insight and self-awareness around that stuff anyway, recognizing.
But before we move off that point, do you think all traumatic experiences can be flipped? I feel like the line between post-traumatic stress and post-traumatic growth is just like a matter of time and the amount of work you're willing to do. And that's not a scientific opinion by any stretch of the imagination. But, you know, it feels like it's just like the lens. It's like one of the things that I've taken out of my psychedelic experiences is that there's an infinite number of ways to look at every experience. And, you know, the one you choose to stick with is the one that sticks, but it doesn't have to be that story.
Yeah, I think I'd lean real heavy on somebody who's a lot more experienced and knowledgeable on that and quote Viktor Frankl, that all suffering ceases to be suffering as soon as it finds a purpose.
Right.
From his book, you know, Man's Search for Meaning. But it can be incredibly difficult for your own particular circumstances to find that purpose. And I think if you can't, then yeah, it can be absolutely debilitating and end you eventually one way or another, or at least contribute to the end of you. But if you can figure out a way to find a meaning and make some meaning out of whatever you've suffered, then yeah, the switch flips and you start to get some traction on what I like to call with clients the upward spiral. We're all familiar with the downward spiral of trauma and depression and anxiety, and anything that can go wrong will grow wrong, and Murphy's Law, and boy, you know, Charlie Brown in it through life, and good grief, everything, you know, is my fault on top of it. And but if you can get something to flip the other direction, then there is actually a corresponding upward spiral where things start to go your way. You do start to like get surprised by joy instead of surprised by anguish, and you know, trying to help people flip that switch is what I spend most of my time professionally doing at this point.
Yeah,
you know, psychiatry and ketamine assisted therapy and coaching some athletes and that sort of stuff. Yeah. So yeah, I do think it's possible, and I think, you know, much more experienced, smarter people than me would agree, at least Viktor Frankl being one, and then anybody else who's fallen in line with him.
Well, certainly nobody on that advisory committee. All you advisory committee members listening right now,
just keep that in mind. Debbie Downers.
Yeah.
It's not the critic who counts, not the one who points out how the strong men fell or how the doer of deeds might have done them better, as you know, a former U.S. president might have famously said at one point. Yeah. Now I lost where I was with my...
I believe we're at very loving, occasionally violent upbringing. Yeah.
And I've always felt like I was kind of like Heidegger has this famous concept of thrownness, that we're all just thrown into the universe. And I felt like I was kind of a fastball and didn't really get the chance to figure out what was even going on until I landed in a catcher's mitt like 10 minutes ago or whatever. But played a bunch of sports, you know, football, basketball, baseball, track, boxing, wrestling, a bunch of extracurricular activities. I just had lots of energy, was the product of a bunch of different systems, went to a Christian school and was homeschooled for a year, and then went to public school. And I had intended to join the military like my dad, and just wanted to, like, I was like, oh, you can get paid to exercise and blow things up. Why isn't there a much longer line? What did I miss in the pamphlet from, you know, the recruiter here? Why isn't everybody signed up to do this? Well, you know, I figured that out later on, that there's a lot of bullshit involved with joining the military. But I was gonna enlist straight out of high school and discovered I was colorblind, and that disqualified me from a bunch of the jobs that I wanted to do. Wanted to be, you know, superhero, you know, Navy SEAL, pararescue, special forces, whatever. And they wouldn't let me into any of those jobs. So I just went to college instead. Yeah, they, you know, laid out the options, and I was like, I don't like any of those, I guess I'll leave. Tried to cobble together my own like civilian version of that by getting a double major in outdoor education and intercultural studies with a minor in Swahili.
And really, a minor in Swahili?
Dio Kabisa. It's super rusty, and it's been about 15 years since I was in East Africa, but yeah, I learned enough to survive there for almost a year. Yeah, it was pretty fun. But getting a bachelor's degree in climbing rocks in other countries didn't really, you know, no career sort of distilled out of doing that. And then, you know, fell in love, and that ruined everything, like it always does. You know, best laid plans and all of that sort of stuff. I think at the time I was doing wilderness therapy half of the time, and then teaching wilderness and medicine and emergency medicine and search and rescue classes all over the country. And she was teaching for AmeriCorps, and we'd see each other like 5 days a month or something while we were engaged. I was like, all right, we got to figure some stuff out, settle down. And went back to school, got a Master of Divinity degree. I was going to go be a Bible translator. I had done a bunch of survey work in East Africa with some tribes out there. I always kind of had an interest in language and linguistics and stuff, and decided to go to seminary to try to pursue that as a career. And along the way, joined the National Guard, the, you know, two weeks in the summer, one weekend a month bullshit on the recruiter poster. Was like, oh yeah, that's a pretty good deal, I can get money for college and all of that sort of stuff. And then that turned into a deployment to Iraq, in the middle of seminary. I was like taking seminary classes in Iraq. Like, it was just a terrible idea, man. Like just too much all at one time.
Love thy neighbor unless they are a terrorist or live in Iraq.
Unless they're not exactly like me. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Unless they are infidels.
Yeah, we, started a family, deployed, had a come back from the deployment, and I was pretty messed up, if I'm being honest, in retrospect, after that deployment. And it was sort of like a slow trickle towards a lot more unhealth, a lot more drinking, a lot more, just kind of self-medicating, a lot more unhealthy habits on a whole bunch of levels, and just trying to figure out what the heck I was doing. But also, I'm not a quitter, so I was going to finish seminary whether I still, believed there was a God or not. I was having a whole bunch of those sorts of struggles. But you know what? We're going to finish this thing because we started it or whatever. I wound up graduating from there and went on. The best kept secret in the military in the United States is something called the AGR program, the Active Guard Reserve program, where you are on active duty. I was a staff sergeant working full time in uniform, but it's in the National Guard. So it's like the skeleton crew of just your buddies that I'd, gone to Iraq with. So like the 8 or 9 of us would all just take care of everything while nobody was there. And it was only one weekend a month that all of the idiots would show up and create problems for us. Where like in the regular army, those idiots are there all day, every day, making problems for you. So it's just the best kept secret out there. If you can land an AGR gig, like that's a really good career for sure. And was an okay enough medic in that regard that they wound up sending me to physician assistant school through the military, the Inter-Service Physician Assistant Program, or IPAP. Another really well-kept secret where I got paid staff sergeant pay the entire time that I was in PA school to go to school. Like everybody else that are my civilian counterparts are coming out with $250,000 in debt. And I got paid to do that the whole time. Now I will say, if you want someone to teach you medicine, you're probably going to have to pay them. If you want someone to pay you to teach yourself medicine, that's how some of that stuff felt at times, because of the amount of information that was just being dumped on us. It was like, we jokingly called the first phase just like being academically jumped into a gang. It's like exams are on Mondays and Fridays, or sometimes Wednesdays. And also there's a whole bunch of army bullshit too. Like, hey, you got an exam on Friday, but you will also be out on the parade ground at 4 o'clock in the morning because we're having a mandatory fun run. And it's okay for you to wear your Halloween costume if you want to. And you can bring the kids too. My kids are asleep, man. It's 4 o'clock in the morning and I don't want to wear a costume. I want to study for this exam. Yeah, well, too bad. You're going to run 5 miles real, real, real slow around this parade ground in your Deadpool costume, buddy. All right, well, let's do this anyway. And got through that. It was a really good experience for me overall. One of the more challenging things I've ever done, but learned a ton along the way. It was in the second phase when I was doing my emergency medicine rotation at Fort Campbell that I wound up getting the news about a friend of mine dying by suicide. And then the next day, a young lady came into the emergency room via ambulance for an intentional overdose. Mm-hmm. And I understood like the emergency medicine side of that. I'd been a combat medic for a decade at that point, had worked street EMS, a bunch of wilderness medicine stuff, knew how to intubate her and participate in the team that was stabilizing her. And then, I knew like the prognosis isn't great after a first suicide attempt. Lots of people try again. Yeah. And depending on how long she'd been unconscious, did she have an anoxic brain injury? Like, was this ruining her life even if she did live after this? A lot of those sorts of questions that I'd never even really been confronted with or hadn't thought a whole lot about at that level. But being confronted with the loss of a friend and then seeing somebody the next day.
Yeah.
Really impacted me. And actually, because I had the Master of Divinity degree, I like did the Jedi mind trick on the chief of the emergency room and said, like, hey, can I go with the chaplain to talk to the family? And like being a student, they kind of want you to optimize your experiences rather than just like, hey, man, you got to go plug back into that computer and start seeing patients again or whatever. Went into the room with this guy and I could have been like looking in a mirror, like his kids were my kids' age and he was, maybe a little bit younger than me, but like this could have been, my family. Like, and it just broke my heart. And sometimes you find sometimes you find your calling by what you're good at, and sometimes it's the stuff that hurts. And I felt real strongly like I had wanted to go into emergency medicine. I'm kind of an adrenaline junkie, but wanted to do something about mental health instead at that point. Just felt something break loose inside of me. And after I graduated, went into outpatient psychiatry with a friend of mine in Louisville, Kentucky, who was a mentor to me coming straight out of school. And it was, you know, I got my license in February of 2020 and the planet shut down about a week later. It was a super weird time to be starting a medical career for sure.
Yep.
And wound up the doctor that hired me was just way ahead of his time. He was always trying to stay on, you know, the cutting edge of research out there. So he was doing ketamine infusions outpatient since I think he started doing it in like 2017.
Oh, wow.
Like decent data around that only really got published in 2015 or so, and not even like systematic review meta-analysis level stuff till like 2021 or so. Yeah. And he was already doing it, so he kind of handed that aspect of the practice to me to kind of to manage. So it was kind of a baptism by fire, where there were a lot of people who we would have normally maybe wanted to go inpatient into a hospital, but because of COVID you didn't want to send anybody to the hospital because of the know acuteness and the level of suicidality and suffering that these people were having. And I was trying to manage them, you know, outpatient, and did the best that I could. And, you know, we didn't lose anybody out of that particular, you know, relatively small practice, but we all kind of made it through the pandemic together alive. And, you know, true to form, I've always kind of, like I said, taken a beating for the most part and just kept on going. It was around the time that I started to get ahead, you know, in building that practice and getting a, you know, full panel of patients, that I got a notification of sourcing that my National Guard unit was going to deploy to Kosovo in Europe. So I wound up having to shut down my part of the practice and hand it off to someone else who's, you know, still there doing an excellent job, and had to go spend, you know, a bunch of time preparing for the deployment, and then deploy over to Europe for most of 2022. And then came back from there. And 3 months later did the MAPS training that we were talking about before. And have been, you know, staying busy, just doing a bunch of random contracts ever since, doing, you know, kind of building my own ketamine assisted therapy practice here in Louisville, Kentucky, one person at a time.
Yeah.
But trying to do it what I believe is the right way, and is like optimizing for that particular person's health isn't necessarily a great business model, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
We I do built a lot a whole more
business around that, and it was right? not a good business model.
Yeah, the lifetime value on healing people and just sending them on their way isn't, you know, a great way to necessarily make a living. So it winds up being a lot like a side hustle at this point. And I'm working full time in the emergency room again, at one of the university hospitals down here. And that's what I do now, is I go in and clock in, clock out, take care of people in between, try to take care of it. I do a bunch of rational deprescribing, is what I call it at this point, out of the ketamine practice, where like people come in on this fistful of meds that doesn't make sense to anybody involved. And I've been there, like I've painted myself into a corner as a prescriber. This isn't any kind of criticism on any of that, but like helping people just kind of walk safely, gradually off of the first medicine that seems like we could get them off of, you know, invariably a benzodiazepine that they're taking far more than they need, you know, really want to, but feel like they need to at this point or whatever. And then once they're feeling great, I hand them off to another therapist for long-term therapy stuff, because I'm not that guy.
Right.
I know my strengths and I know my weaknesses, and I want to I think of it as interventional psychiatry, helping somebody with what I'm good at, and then handing them off to somebody who'd be better at, you know, walking through life with them for the next 10 years, because I get bored. I don't want to see you forever.
Fuck off. You're better. Get lost. I'm done with you.
Yeah. Walk it off. All right.
Stand up and walk it up. What the hell did you do in Kosovo? Like, not a whole lot happening in Eastern Europe these days, is there?
Yeah. You know, it's been since the Clinton era that we've been involved in a NATO mission over there. So I think we were like the 30th or 31st group of people from the U.S. to rotate through the Kosovo forces mission there, trying to minimize the level of friction between Serbia and Kosovo on a whole bunch of different levels. I was they call it a battalion surgeon for an infantry battalion. So there were about, 200 infantry bubbas that I was responsible for just being kind of the primary healthcare point of care person for them. And okay. I had a dozen medics working under me. It was actually a really great tour for me. I had a lot of fun, got to get out into the mountains and do some high angle training with NATO partners and teach a bunch of classes, and had a really good group of medics that we used to do, epic PT routines with once a week. I just, make everybody super sad. It's like, yeah, we're going to do walking lunges for a mile today.
You got to be the guy making them do the 5 miles in Deadpool costumes.
Yeah, exactly. Nice. Carrying each other, buddy carries, pick a buddy that's bigger than you, come get me. Yeah. There were a couple of people who got real, real sick who might not have been okay if there hadn't been somebody competent there to take care of them or whatever. And right. I was glad to be that guy. It was a good experience overall. I watched Top Gun 2.
Good movie.
In a movie theater with English subtitles, with a couple of, with like my battalion commander and executive officer and stuff. And the tickets got paid for by some elderly gentleman from Kosovo who kind of remembers the initial wave of attempted genocide right. there in the 90s. And he absolutely would not let us pay for our own popcorn. So just one of those sort of fun nice. Cross-cultural experiences, like the level of gratefulness for the people that remember the good things that America's done overseas. It's not all doom and gloom and terror, that sort of thing. We do help
every once in a while.
It's important to keep that in mind.
Yeah.
We're like, I think globally we're like a more, we're more like an excited puppy. Like we just want to help and we come in there, but we're like waving our tail around and we're like in a China shop, trying to help and just making a mess some of the times, but a lot of well-intentioned stuff, at least in my very limited experience as a psychedelic Forrest Gump. I neglected to mention, like, I was on the personal security detail in Iraq for like Lloyd Austin, who's the Secretary of Defense now. I was like the medic there. So like I stood in the corner of some important rooms, like was in palaces in Iraq and just crazy little experiences there near the end, because I was one of the last soldiers out in 2011.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Which is just a weird time to be in the country for sure.
Yeah, I imagine so. A lot covered in there. I guess I forgot my last question. I had another question come up recently, but it's now gone. So we'll go back to this one. You talked about, mental health. And one of the questions that's come up for me is I always feel like mental health is too limited of a descriptor, right? Like it makes it sound like it's your brain. And even though it gives people the willies, to me, it's much more spiritual health, right? Going back to that early conversation about like, if you find a purpose for your suffering, you can turn it from post-traumatic stress to post-traumatic growth. But to believe that there's a purpose implies something somewhat higher order, if you really sort of think about it, right? Which takes it out of the realm of this is biochemistry and this is how it works, being like, oh, there's a reason I went through that. I'm so curious to know where you stand on that. And it also invites the question of having gone through divinity school. It's probably the same question, just asked a different way. Like, where did you end up on the question of, is there God? And, is a bearded white dude walking around the desert in Israel, or, what's your conception of that?
Right. Yeah. I think we're at the back end of recognizing both the benefits and the costs of the sort of restrictive, eliminative materialism of the 20th century philosophically. There's a whole bunch of benefits in like the research lab and a whole bunch of detriments in like the gulag associated with those sorts of things. And we're starting just baby stepping towards figuring some things out about how to bring together all this quote unquote ancient wisdom and ways that it's been done that helped us to get to the place where we're at, but without necessarily, believing in anything. So that's some of the difficult way of trying to navigate some of this stuff is I wind up being remarkably skeptical and completely open and trying to hold that tension the best that I can. Like I, you know, say in the book, my purpose in life is to embody all of life's paradoxes in a way that overcomes fear with love, is what I come back to over and over again as a way of trying to figure some of those sorts of things out. Like there's some really big questions, especially psychedelic experiences can open you up to how much of the, you know, neuroplasticity that we recognize is going on in like a mouse's brain when we do the sorts of studies that we do to figure those things out, and then compare to the imaging studies that we're allowed to do in human brains to figure out like what's going on inside of somebody compares, you know, with what's going on in a newborn through adolescent periods of life where there's just a lot of brain being grown in the first place. You know, I don't think everybody, it's becoming more recognized that it's like 25, 26, 7 years old before you get like hard concrete between your ears instead of this soft mush of like a, you know, pupa in a chrysalis kind of thing. And you get to reset that a little bit on some psychedelics. And then you get this psychedelic space that's super interesting where, yeah, there's a lot of, you know, woo-woo. I got to get a degree from the woo-woo university at this point or whatever about stuff that's just beyond our ability to understand or quantify meaningfully in a research setting doesn't necessarily mean that it's garbage that should be entirely thrown out. We need to develop different tools for how to find truth in those contexts is where I kind of land. Like I had a philosophy professor a long time ago that called it the crackers in the pantry fallacy. Like if you approach every question as if it's, are there crackers in the pantry or not? You're going to miss out on a whole lot more information than just, can I find crackers or not? And yeah, if that's all you care about is crackers, okay.
Is there anything else to care about though?
Right? You know, there's such an array of crackers, delicious Triscuit crackers in the car, man. So I think trying to develop new tools, like that's the promise that's been held out from psychedelics, especially like Stan Grof's famous quote of, what the microscope was for biology and the telescope was for astronomy, psychedelics will be for psychology, is a great concept. But what exactly does the data of a psychedelic experience look like? Like, what is the analog there? How do we figure some of that stuff out? Because there's a bunch of ways to talk real science-y about what are actually just trip reports that overlap over and over and over again.
Yeah.
You know, like a good book to get his take on it is The Cosmic Game.
Okay.
Where he talks about kind of his perspective on bringing together what he calls holotropic data. But really, like I listened to all the holotropic data and it's like, well, okay, so it's reincarnation seems more likely than not, given how many people have an experience from psychedelics that relate to that. Also, probably aliens are real because so many people talk to aliens. What, you know, like, what are we going to do with all of this stuff that is going to get you kicked out still of like an FDA advisory panel type situation?
Yeah.
But that still also winds up being the most meaningful experiences of people's lives.
Yeah.
How do we bring those two things together in a synthesis that doesn't sacrifice one for the other? I'm all in for let's figure out how to do that.
So is there a God or not?
So it's all, you know, it's like the famous Bill Clinton, like it depends on the definition of is. It depends on the definition of God, right? If you mean, you know, some particular parochial deity of some particular book, I'm a lot more skeptical of that than I used to be, given that I have a degree in one of those books in particular. But the idea that there's an ultimate mystery to be explored, and that that mystery is interactive and has some level of personal qualities to him, her, it, they, them, whatever it might be, I'm on board for that, the idea of a creator or a source of all life or something beyond our capacity. I call it zero in my own head or whatever. Like the byline on my book is the zero with 1,000 faces.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, you can get to this level of recognizing the oneness aspect of things. This is a lot more, you know, prevalent in Eastern religions, Buddhism of one stripe or another, or Hinduism of one stripe or another. But there seems to be a mystic streak in virtually every organized religion out there that I kind of, at the current moment anyway, feel a level of coherence with beyond anything else, is this recognition of the mystery behind all of these other things, and that there's ways of trying to point at that mystery meaningfully and engage with it and learn about it, but never ultimately comprehend completely.
Yep. Yeah.
So if you define God as a mystery that we can't understand, you know, is utterly incomprehensible, then yes, I believe in that. If that's even coherent to say in the first
place. Yeah, no, right. Listen, it is. I think we talked about it last time, but, quantum physics. And Randy Sherlock, who was our medical director and field trip in LA, you know, talked about how entanglement seems to suggest things move faster than the speed of light, right? Mm-hmm. And according to Einsteinian laws of physics, that's not possible. So how do you reconcile that? Maybe all the data that we have in quantum physics, even though it's the most scientifically accurate data we've ever compiled for science, apparently in humanity, is wrong. Or maybe there's something out of space time, outside of space time. And that seems like the very logical answer, is that there's something operating outside of space time. And I remember philosophically, you know, every dimension needs the next higher dimension to be perceived, right? You know, width can only be perceived if you can see it from above. Otherwise, there's no. So, like, you think about it, being like, of course, you know, if we can perceive the four dimensions of space time, then there's got to be a fifth dimension from which it's perceived from.
Which is where all the angels and the aliens are that we talk to on psychedelic journeys.
Well, that may be exactly where they are. Exactly. So, I don't know.
The Anunnaki, that's where they're from.
My stepson is in Vietnam right now. And obviously you can't speak for your dad, but I'm curious to know your thoughts. Where just the other day I was like, oh my God, I'm like, so many American teens are running around Vietnam, you know, having fun, getting drunk, partying, exploring. It's awesome. You know, that's just like, it sounds pretty amazing, but I wonder how it must feel for, and we're not there with Iraq yet, although I presume eventually we may get there. How it must have felt for vets, you know, to kind of be like, I went there, I lost friends, like I suffered incalculably to fight a war, and now like the next generations of kids are just basically going partying. Like, on one level you could see that as we achieve something worthwhile and we opened up the world and all that kind of stuff. On another hand, I could see like how that would be a giant kick in the pants, being like, what the fuck, you know, we gave up all that for this, like what the hell. I don't know, do you have any sense about, like, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it's a good litmus test for, you know, how much have I healed,
right?
Like, how much does this trigger me? It's not a question of like I can just kind of roll it around, right? Like, this makes me real angry on a particular day, like these guys take everything I did for granted, and you know that that's in there, and I got to be honest about that being in there. But as I get the opportunity to reflect on it, like, why did I do all of this in the first place? Why did I want to serve? Mixed reasons, right?
Yeah.
Like, and if I get back to like the core of a bunch of those sorts of reasons, it's, I want peace, right? I want people to be able to go and play and enjoy the world and feel safe to, you know, some degree while they're doing it. So whenever I engage with kind of the most healed parts of me, it doesn't bother me at all. I say, fucking send it, go enjoy, you know, enjoy the shit out of that or whatever. But sometimes, you know, like I see what they're actually doing, you know, it's like, that's some dumb shit. And I can't believe I fucking sacrificed for them to be able to do that dumb shit over there or whatever, you know, like you can be a real, real fucking grump about it. It's like the classic example around here that goes around on social media is like the guy who's triggered by fireworks on the 4th of July and wants the whole neighborhood to like be in mourning with him. And I get it. I've been there. Yeah. Like I've felt that way for sure. And yeah, the whole world feels dark from in that hole, and you just want it to be quiet, or you want it to go away or whatever. Like it's a tough spot to be in. And then there's the guy who puts the sign out on his, you know, front porch that says, fire them fireworks because I miss war. It's my favorite. You know, like, it's been a long time and those were some of the best memories with some of the best people. It was a whole bunch of that shit. You know, like, I don't know if that's completely healed at that point, but they're just two very different perspectives. What's behind those perspectives, I think, is just how much you're able to kind of engage with the more resilient, more healed parts of yourself. Does that kind of answer your question?
Yeah. Yeah, it does, which is both kind of responses are fair, I guess is the right answer. And they can coexist within the same person, you know, place and time, moment. And all of that can be like, fuck those kids. Like, no goddamn respect.
Get off my lawn. Yeah.
I need a reason to use my shotgun again.
Right.
But yeah,
no one will be able to pick out this gunshot among all of these fireworks if you ain't careful there. You know, well, like the opposite of like one deep truth isn't a superficial falsehood. It's another deep truth over and over again. And to the degree that you're able, I think, to hold the tension between two deep truths inside of you, that's where you're going to find the most reliably beautiful, good truth-y experience that you can have here in the third dimension.
No, that goes right back to the mystery, being like, can you hold two equally true but potentially diametrically opposed truths at the same time, because they can coexist. And I feel like in our society, at least in social media and the news and politics, people don't think they can. But I think the people who are paying attention are like, that's the only way you're going to get through is by holding them at the same time and letting both coexist. You know? Mm-hmm.
Schrodinger's cat is dead and alive.
It sure just like is.
You and me.
No one likes cats anyway, so who cares?
Rub them all the wrong way.
Exactly. All right. Question number two. Who have been the most influential teachers in your life?
Yeah. I mean, my dad,
yeah,
obviously, I mentioned he had a big influence on me during my formative years. My mom as well. My mom was a speech pathologist and a real smart lady and, you know, took real great care of me down through the years that I was real young there. So, between the two of them, I owe them a great deal of gratitude and all the love that they gave me. And then I had, you know, good teachers in high school. The shop teacher kind of took me under his wing, so I kind of
feel like shop teachers are the ones that do this, right? Like, it just it seems like the shop teacher, it's not going to be the math teacher.
Yep, he was the track coach too, and you know, I was going to get myself in trouble for the kind of thing that, like, I guess you could get locked up for now, you know, like you'd go streaking or something, and he'd be like, hey man, look, like, pull me aside, like, look, you can't do that shit. Yeah, I guess I could get in trouble for that. I hadn't thought about that. I don't have the part of my brain yet that knows not to do that dumb shit or whatever. And he stepped in. Shout out to Chuck Holzinger there. The shop teacher was a great mentor to me. I had two great mentors in undergrad. This is the thing that I've managed to just stumble over and over again into finding really good mentors at different stages. The whole, like, when the student's ready, the teacher appears thing. I've been fortunate enough to experience without recognizing that was what was happening at the time.
Yep.
The double major, I had outdoor education and intercultural studies. So I had an advisor in both of them, and they were incredible men. Absolutely. Very impressive family men and academics and teachers. The outdoor ed faculty advisor, Bob Smalley, was really influential on me. Just kind of his way of teaching in like a non-directive approach that comes out of like the Outward Bound Gordonson School from Kurt Hahn was really influential on just the way that I led mountaineering expeditions without being like extra, you know, alpha dickhead about it, but was able to kind of be more Jeet Kune Do Bruce Lee philosophically about whether we're going to die on this glacier or not. Was definitely his influence. And then John Aronson was a PhD anthropologist that had translated the Bible into the Merle language in Southern Sudan in the 1970s, just very linguistically gifted. But he was he would teach these classes, and students would debate, like, hey, is he a really good teacher, or does he just tell really good stories? And we'd all kind of resolve, like, it doesn't really matter. Yeah. Like, it's amazing. Like, you'd sit in these classes, like, and tons of people would just audit his classes to sit in and hear the crazy stories from his life. I certainly aspired to be like them to some degree in my own way, and owe a great deal of gratitude to them. I have it's funny. I'm remembering that we had dress up like your favorite teacher day in high school. Yeah. I dressed up like the shop teacher and shaved my head and put on a fake beard and got him into trouble because we did announcements in the school. And there was a couple girls and me and my buddy that would do the school announcements, and the girls sat on my lap while we did the announcements, and the principal thought that the shop teacher had students sitting on his lap during the school announcement. He's like, you keep getting me in trouble over and over again. And I the reason I thought of that was John Aronson was also bald. And I did that when we were on a semester abroad in Tanzania, taught a whole class pretending to be him, and would, shaved my head just like him, dyed it a little bit, stole one of his Oxford sweaters to wear, and just had a great time of, pretending to be like my heroes there anyway. Yeah. And then I had great mentors in the military along the way. For sure, I lucked out to have, when I went to Iraq, I was 3.5 years into a part-time military career and had gotten promoted to staff sergeant, which is just way too fast. There's no reason anybody should make rank that quickly. And then when we got in country, I got a job promotion to a platoon sergeant role, which is usually somebody who's been in 12 or 15 years of full-time doing this stuff. But the guy that was doing it got himself into some trouble and wound up getting fired, and I wound up kind of filling in that role. And there were a bunch of really good NCOs who were much more experienced, had been on a bunch of deployments before, who kind of took me under their wing and were like, hey man, if you need any help with it, you're a smart guy, but also you haven't been around a whole lot. Yeah. And you need some help or whatever. And they saw that. Dan Truex is a guy I had on my podcast for an interview, who's just an amazing person who I've looked up to and as kind of a peer along the way. He and I career-wise have kind of stayed neck and neck. We're both captains in the National Guard at this point. Okay. He's a Lexington detective, police officer, entrepreneur further down the line than me, runs a pretty big security company here in Kentucky. I really appreciate him a ton. Had really good commanders along the way. The guy that hired me as an AGR, Tim Stark, I'm not a big political activist guy, but if Tim Stark ran for office somewhere, I'd go door to door and hand out leaflets. He's a small number of officers that I'd follow wherever they're going.
Right.
He's a great guy. And I had some really good instructors in IPAP as well. Colonel James Jones is just an incredible individual. He was the White House medical officer under Obama for both tours, took care of the Obama family as their primary care manager, the first PA to ever fill that role instead of an MD.
Oh, wow.
Just an amazing person who I can still kind of reach out to for advice today. He's active on social media and stuff. Just an incredible guy. Super smart, just ridiculously smart, scary smart. And then second phase, I had, Major Scott Joelman, who looked out for me a bunch. Just, there's some cool people running the Fort Campbell site there. And coming out afterwards, there's Bob Stewart, who was the psychiatrist that hired me straight out of PA school into psychiatry. He's just a legend in my mind. He certainly has contributed to a great deal of what spiritual health in Louisville, Kentucky.
There you go. Not
mere mental health. He's a great man. And then I've gotten the chance to work with some amazing doctors out of Wild Health who've also become my friends, guys like Matt Dawson and Mike Mallon, and their wives have become my friends. Matt's wife, Kristen Dawson's a psychiatrist in Lexington that I've done some work with. She's amazing. One of the smartest, kindest psychiatrists that I've ever met in my life. A bunch of other docs there. Mike Stone wrote the foreword to my book. He was Harvard emergency medicine faculty and a good friend who I could just call up if I needed, a shoulder to cry on at this point. Good dudes. Carl Seeger and Luke Murray are other friends that, I describe it as people who are more me than me, in good ways. I can look up to them as oh yeah, this resonates, but they're better at this a whole lot than I am, so I can reach out and say hey, how do I unfuck this particular situation. So over and over again, I've just managed to fall headlong into spaces where there are people who are just better people than me to learn from. And like, I probably, if I thought about it, could go on all day talking about the just really impressive people that I've been fortunate enough to be friends with or mentored by.
That's awesome. Just a quick note on the prophet, the teacher who just told good stories. I realized that so much of that is lacking. Like, actually, podcast is a great forum. Like, everyone has a book, it seems, these days, and is promoting a book, but there's so much that you don't get from a book that you get from hearing the story being told directly, or hearing all the details that don't make it into the book. And that's kind of the hope for this podcast, is like, how people tell the story is as important as the story itself in many ways. So, and it's interesting you touch on that.
Yeah.
Looking back on your life, what is one thing growing up that you wanted more than anything? And what is one thing that you would have done differently?
You know, second question first, invest in Bitcoin, right? Like, nobody expected that shit to take off like it did. Huh. Yeah. Early, you know, jump on that one, time travel.
I remember, my first business was a Cash for Gold store, and I saw Bitcoin taking off. It was hitting those all-time highs of $800. And I'm like, we should get a Bitcoin machine, because in a sense, we're just primarily an FX. We trade precious metals for cash, but it's no different than trading Canadian pesos for US dollars. So we got one, but I remember it hit $1,000. And that come down, I'm like, fuck, we missed it.
Yeah. I know a guy who woke up one day and had like 10 million more in his coin wallet or whatever. Yeah. It was like, oh God, I got to call my accountant. What do I even do? Did I break the law? Did something go wrong? How did I get 10 more million dollars in one night?
Jesus. You know?
Yeah. Dump that stuff. So second question was first. And then the first question was, adventure has been at the heart of a bunch of things for me. I was always kind of like a joy seeker. I just wanted to have adventures with cool people. Honestly, I joined the military more than anything else just to try to like make some friends who also were the same kind of twisted, sense of humor and wanted to have some crazy adventures or whatever. Like, yes, freedom and apple pie and America and mom and GI Bill and
Tom Petty. Sort of I feel stuff. Like you got to drop Tom Petty in there.
Yeah. At the time it was Three Doors Down had the like Citizen Soldier video that like they did a music like a rock song to or whatever that was like, oh yeah, all right, let's do this or whatever. For anybody in that era, they'll know. Like, they were playing it in movie theaters as a preview and stuff like that. But yeah, I just wanted to make friends and have a lot of fun. Yeah. It's probably been the driving force behind a ton of stuff in retrospect.
Is that still, your MO today, or has that changed?
Yeah, I think so. Cool. I think that's what I'm all about. Yep. Yeah.
What dreams do you have for the rest of your life?
Yeah. You know, I was struggling with that recently. Yeah. My wife and I've been talking about it a bunch. And after some of like last year was a crazy year in my world for sure. And I looked at my bucket list and I checked a bunch of these blocks early.
Yeah.
Like I wanted to write a book. I wanted to, travel the world. I wanted to, blah, blah, blah. Now, like a lot of the list in my, I need to reevaluate all of that. So I don't have great goals beyond, just being a provider for my family at this point is what a lot of it looks like. And I'm shifting perspective to where I want to listen much more carefully to my wife and my kids and make my list overlap a lot more with theirs. It's been kind of the Ben show for way too long, and I'm kind of sick of my own bullshit at this point. That was some of why I started my podcast in the first place, was like, I wrote this book and I felt like I was kind of sick of my own stories. Yep. And just wanted to hear other people's. So I started asking people to come share their stories on the podcast. And I really don't talk that much on my podcast. I just ask some questions and interject some random jokes or whatever, but really enjoy hearing what other people's stories are. But yeah, at this point, like, I just want them to flourish more than anything. They're all kind of proxy goals rather than like, yep, I want to climb the seven summits, or I want to sock away X number of dollars, or, some of them are just kind of maintaining a level of health that I've acquired. And, you know, enjoying things, you know, time with friends and that sort of stuff. But I don't have like a big goal on the horizon of like, yep, I want to, you know, start a business and exit in X number of years for X number of dollars. I don't want to do it. I don't care.
Yep.
I don't, you know, I have a friend invited me to go climb a mountain with him. And a little bit, I was like, I think I'd rather just be with my kids. Like yeah. I'll have a lot more just domestic goals. Like I went on a long run in the woods yesterday, reflected on some of this stuff and was like, you know, like I missed a bunch of when they were young because of the military and being gone. And a ton of like what's in my heart is trying to make up for that lost time to the degree that you can. Like all my kids are getting old enough. They're not going to hold my hand anymore. Yeah. The littlest one will still do it from time to time. But like I miss that. I miss those days, you know, and I just want to make the most out of it. So making my family flourish is kind of what's left for me at this point, as far as goals go.
I feel like that's the definition of middle age when you get to that point where you've achieved a lot of the things you set out. I had a bucket list. I haven't looked at it in years, but I remember I think there's 75 or 80 or maybe 100 things on it. And I was at 44, 50, something like that, like checked off. And I'm like, like all right. of that, like if I get the
none of them were that great. Yeah. I was like, okay, well we did that.
That's the other thing too. I think that's like one of the fundamental realizations and probably the biggest, we'll call it a con for lack of a better word, of you know, capitalism, hustle culture, entrepreneurship, being like, oh, if you just like, you know, there's a lot of wonderful things about entrepreneurship, there's no doubt about it, but you do that thing, you sell the business, you hit that number, and then you realize that, okay, well, maybe making ends meet is no longer one of your struggles, which for a lot of people is a huge struggle, but all those other struggles that actually keep you up at night, they're still there. And now you don't have that dream that you keep yourself focused on to distract you from all those other troubles, because you always believe that satisfying that dream is going to solve them, and then don't. And you're like, oh shit, now I don't have any dreams and I still got all my problems. And it's like, oh fuck. And lo and behold, that happens right around, I don't know, I suspect you're around the same age, right around 45. You're like, huh.
Yeah.
And all that other shit I wanted to do, I don't really care so much anymore. And speaking of holding hands, you know, last week I was with both of my kids and I was tired and grumpy and like we were walking around and like holding my kids' hands is lovely, but sometimes it feels like shackles, being like, sometimes I just want to be able to scratch my nose without having to let go of your hand. Like I just want that. But I kept coming back to the place of like, you know, this does not last that much longer. And so as much as my nose is fucking itchy right now, I will continue to hold your hand.
Yeah, the be here now from old Ram Dass / Richard Alpert has been kind of a mantra for me more than anything else lately, is like just being comfortable in what exactly is in front of me right now and navigating that from the best parts of me that I can access is what I'm focused on a lot of the time. And that's who's in front of me over and over and over again is my family there. So I have these weird experiences. You ever have this experience where you know how they say like your life passes before you at the end or whatever, you have like the slideshow and people suggest that happens if like ibogaine in particular has this slideshow quality
to interesting.
Or whatever in psychedelic, you know, reports from what I've heard. Again, I'm ridiculously psychedelically naive as a user, but
you talk the game well.
Like I know the words. And I've practiced the ketamine assisted therapy quite a bit, but for the most part, I'm a pretty happy guy and I'm still in the military. So haven't had the opportunity to explore the psychonautic universe just yet. Eventually someday I'll get there. But in any event, like I have these experiences where like I'm aware that what I'm seeing right now in front of me, especially like with my family, like my kids were like checking out a baby cow with my wife that we like the front field or whatever I was letting the neighbor use for his cows to, you know, it keeps the grass down, whatever. But they went out and they're just like fawning over this baby cow that had been born like the day before. And I kind of pulled back and looked at them for a second. And I had this like feeling like we're taking a snapshot, like this memory's being collected for that slideshow at the end or whatever. Like I can feel it in the moment. You ever having a weird experience like that?
Yeah, for sure. My business partner from Field Trip, Joseph, he said, you know, scientifically, actually, if you like make a camera with your fingers, apparently I'm not doing it very well right now, but if you actually do this,
L7 wiener.
If you actually do this, well, in those moments, you remember it better. Like it crystallizes the memory in your head. But I've certainly had those moments just being like, oh, this is awesome. This is like, it's usually a fairly innocuous moment, like fawning over a cow. And you're just like, oh yeah, this is what it was all for. But
totally worth
doesn't
it.
Sell any books stupid or podcasts.
Right.
All right. This comes back to the comment from the top, which is the question is, what are you doing that to make sure you stick around long enough to achieve that dream? Although the dream sounds fairly fluid and mundane, but not in a negative way. You know, what's your routine? What's your longevity stack? What other means are you doing to keep yourself healthy? And so off the top, if you've been paying attention, which by this point you're probably not, but if you were as a listener paying attention, I had posted something on LinkedIn that Ben had commented on, something to the effect of, you know, I used to biohack, now I prefer intuition. So speak to all of the questions in there.
Yeah, I say that comment, I think, is probably another one of those, like, being in your 40s and having tried a whole bunch of stuff is where you get to that level of trusting your intuition. It's harder to do that without a stack of experiences to base that on. You know, like, I wore the Oura ring. I was like an early adopter when it came out and tried the Whoop strap. Like, I was an early adopter on a ton of the wearables, continuous glucose monitoring, and trying different you know, combinations of foods and orders of proteins to fats to carbs, and don't eat any naked carbs and watch for spikes. And I ate the ketogenic diet strictly for 3 years while I was in PA school and training for ultra marathons at, you know, 220 pounds of body weight, like a whole bunch of the biohacking, like, blocks. I checked them or whatever. And, you know, that's been my advice to a lot of people who are in the thick of figuring some of that stuff out, is don't outsource your intuition in the process of gaining that information and those experiences. So there's people who look at their Oura ring with a level of anxiety that defeats the purpose of having the Oura ring in the first place. Well, like, what did I screw up last night that I got, you know, an 89% instead of a 90%, you know, sleep effectiveness? How much more magnesium do I need to megadose before I go to bed to correct for the shift from NREM to REM sleep in the middle of the night? You know, like, I've been there. And on the other side of it, a whole bunch, like, I learned lessons about what works for me as opposed to just outsourcing it to Andrew Huberman and Peter Attia and Dave Asprey and Ben Greenfield, or whoever your particular, you know, superheroes wind up being that you follow in that regard. By all means, follow them to figure out, you know, what worked for them, and then integrate it into what actually works for you is what I recommend a lot of the time. So, you know, collect the data, but without turning it into a crutch or crippling yourself with it, where it runs your life instead of you running it. There's plenty of times that Oura ring would tell me, hey man, take it easy today, you had a shit night of sleep, and I felt amazing for the first time in 2 weeks. And I'd pull some David Goggins, like, you don't know me, son, we're gonna run 20 miles a day or whatever, you know, like, and I trust my intuition on that over and against whatever, you know, that ring is throwing out. Which is a great tool, by the way, it's awesome or whatever. But at this point, like, all I'm doing is I've figured out the things that work for me, my version of the, you know, Pareto principle, 80-20, that 20% for me that gets me the 80% of the results. Like, I don't even.
And what are those
things? I like the X3 bar.
Okay.
Is what I use for strength training at this point. I'm not a huge fan of, like, the info on it or whatever, but the actual piece of tech is, I think, phenomenal. So they're like the highest tensile strength resistance bands out there that I could find. So it's, you know, a 20 or 30 minute workout with that going, you know, like the way resistance bands work, it winds up being super easy on my joints, super hard on the muscles in terms of contraction that I can get. And, you know, like, I've had 2 hernia repair surgeries from deadlifting. I used to deadlift north of 750 for a 1 rep max back in the day. Wow. Like, pretty decent numbers, but also, you know, got a couple of hernias in the process and now I'm trying to minimize injury and maximize resistance training. So I think the X3 bar is a great tool for that. I'd still do some Olympic weightlifting sorts of stuff and some body weight stuff, learning how to do zone 2 cardio well and paying attention, like wearing a heart rate strap, but then figuring out what it feels like to be in zone 2 versus zone 3. Yep. Now I can run without them. So I just run, you know, for distance or for time or whatever I've got. So it's a mix of, you know, steady state cardio, that makes sense. Another, and the X3 bar resistance training for exercise. And that those are, you know, big movers is the exercise that you do, right? The first zillionaire will be the person that figures out how to get exercise into a pill. But in the meantime, the rest of us got to do work, son. I go to sleep when I'm tired and I get up when I'm not, as much as I'm able to, even if I, you know, have to work random night shifts or a bunch of that sort of stuff. I figured out that I need to watch something to fall asleep, because that was what I did during formative years. I did a bunch of the like wearing blue light blocking glasses and going to sleep at this particular time and having a whole bunch of, you know, watching the way that I expose myself to light and all of that kind of stuff. But I need something to just distract me a little bit, to do the hypnotic thing that we do where we fall into a dissociative state for 8 hours of the night or whatever. And it doesn't matter how interesting or uninteresting it is. If it's just like the white noise or the drum or whatever of that helps me fall asleep. So yeah, take that, Andrew Huberman. I expose my eyes to light every night and pass the heck out 10 minutes later or whatever. But I had to kind of figure that out for myself, right? That it's the minority report. Most people do benefit from chilling out and calming down and that sort of thing. And then I eat plants and animals. I try to avoid stuff that comes in a box or in a bag because I keep it simple, you know. Supplements wise is pretty minimal. I have some, you know, genetic stuff that suggests I don't convert vitamin D as easily as everybody else. So I use a D supplement and check that once in a while. A lot of the functional mushroom stuff, I like those. So I, you know, take a scoop of mushroom coffee in my actual coffee every day. I do like more like intuitive eating stuff at this point. Like I am not medicating with food anymore. Like during, you know, kind of the period after I got back from Iraq where I said I was just letting it all hang out and self-medicating. Now it's like, I'm, you know, if I'm hungry, I eat a little something. If I'm not, make sure that I'm never too full. It's a lot of this sort of intuition level stuff around that. And then, you know, like the longevity studies all suggest that happiness is just as important as not smoking and exercising. So again, trying to maximize friendships, maximize community, maximize my family's health. It was, you know, the greatest predictor of health at 50 for when you turn 80 was just how satisfied you are in your marriage and in your friendships.
Yep.
In the, you know, the Waldinger Harvard longitudinal studies from way back in the day or whatever. So trying to maximize that. And I don't take a whole bunch of supplements beyond that. I'm not on the Sheila Jeet train or taking any of the Ormus Golds or whatever other mysterious substances are out there.
I hear you. All right. One last question. I didn't realize that we're already at 11 o'clock and I got a call starting right now, but, what's one thing you wish more people knew?
One thing I wish more people knew is that you really can laugh in the face of anything.
Yep.
I think laughter is kind of like trauma proofing to some extent.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I feel like it could also be a defense mechanism. But if it's like a really solid, like sincere laugh, I think.
Yeah. You gotta know yourself on that one, right? Yeah,
you gotta do the drugs.
You don't have a self anymore.
What's that?
You gotta know yourself until you don't have a self anymore.
Exactly. Creatio ex nihilo. We'll never forget that.
Making something out of nothing here.
Oh, great.
Another podcast.
Greatest sin of all time. Awesome, Ben. That's been amazing. Thank you so much for hopping on. Enjoy your new funky space. I hope it's productive for you. And we'll keep having these conversations if you're up for it.
Sounds good, brother.